Hello, welcome back to the HBS podcast, where we talk all things history, philosophy, and social studies of science. I am Samara Greenwood, and today it is my pleasure to have Sarah Kidway as our guest. Sarah is a postdoctoral researcher in the history of science, with a particular focus on British imperialism, science and colonialism, the relation of science and Islam, as well as the history of evolutionary biology. Sarah's dissertation and initial book project focused on the Muslim polymath Sir Syed Ahmad Khan, looking at how he dealt with science in his context, as well as his efforts in science popularization. Sarah is also well known for her community building efforts in the history of science, technology, and medicine, including founding the virtual HIST SDM community during the early years of the pandemic, which proved to be a vital source of connection for many students and academics during a period of great uncertainty. In this week's episode, Sarah introduces us to the topic of science and colonialism, a crucial area of study for understanding many of the features of modern science, as well as reconfiguring our understanding of its history, expanding our vision and challenging many traditional Eurocentric notions of what it takes to really come to grips with understanding this thing we call science. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here.
First, could you tell us a little bit about how you came to history and philosophy of science?
Sure. I started out in the life sciences at the University of Toronto, pre-med, you know, classic immigrant story. And then I took a history class and I absolutely fell in love. But then in my second year, I took some time off and went to work in finance. When I decided to go back to my bachelor's, I found the Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science. So I switched over to HPS and history fully in the third year of my undergrad. And one of the first classes I ever took was the introduction to the history of biology. I was just enamored by the subject. I'd been working in an evolutionary biology lab as well. And I started questioning, what does the reception of Darwinian evolution look like in Muslim contexts? So then I decided that I would do a master's, and I stayed at the University of Toronto because it was a commute from home and wanted to avoid student debt, all of these different things together. Then when I started my master's, Marwal Shakri had just published Reading Darwin in Arabic, and I wanted to do something similar for the South Asian context. I tried to look in the 19th century who had discussed Darwinian evolution, and what I found was this historical actor by the name of Sir Syed Ahmad Khan, someone whose name I had heard from my mom and grandma while growing up. He's quite controversial. He's known as a religious reformer and founder of a college called Aligarh Muslim University, which was established originally in 1875 and becomes a university in 1910. Some websites said that he had discussed Darwinian evolution. And I said, this is it. This is the gap in the literature. When I transitioned from the master's to the PhD, I proposed looking at what Syed Ahmad Khan said about Darwin. I finally found the primary source that discussed Darwinian evolution, or so I thought. But when I translated it, it was originally in the Urdu language to English. You find out that of the pages, there's only one sentence that has to deal with Darwin. The rest of it was this story of how evolution is compatible within Islam. And that sort of narrative didn't exist in the discipline. So in the 19th century, you have a Muslim reformer. This is not a dominant view, but is a view that claims humans were part of the animal kingdom. At that point, I realized approaching this with Darwinism was quite Eurocentric. So I was part of the problem. I realized what we have to do is reset the historiography of the discipline. What that means is go back to square one, convince a few people that this is an important thing to do research on, and start again. So I was lucky enough to start working with Bernie Lightman, who was crazy enough to take on this project. And we started looking at how Syed Ahmad Khan, though he's this massive figure, people have published tens and thousands of publications upon him. There's this small story in his life about his engagement with science that tells this other story and how it affects the sociopolitical context. It's transforming the discipline in a way to look at not just scientists, but popularizers of science and technocrats of science who engage with scientific thought in the 19th century. And that sort of started out my career. So that's a very long way of saying I found history and philosophy of science through accident, but also wonder.
That's a fantastic story to find that figure that then opens up this new pathway. Talking more about that story, what would you say are your main interests in history and philosophy of science?
It's It's really funny because every time I update my bio, I add a new little thing. So broadly speaking, I'm interested in science and imperialism, science and religion, science and Islamic societies, the history of evolutionary biology. Currently, I'm also training in sociology of science and religion. Primarily, I'm working on the long 19th century, and I'm branching out and looking at the development of geology, evolutionary biology, and astronomy through imperial expansion. And so it's a bit of a massive project, but it'll keep me going for many, many years.
Well, that's great, isn't it? A project that keeps on giving. To the central question for today, what is a topic you believe would be of interest and value to a broader audience?
I think it's broadly couched as science and empire or science and colonialism, because it's such a big part of showing how the development of various scientific disciplines is tied in with sociopolitical contexts. And also during a period in the 19th century, where you move from natural history and natural philosophy through more standardized disciplines, it's happening through imperialism. So the classic example is, how was Darwin on the Beagle? Why is Wallace in the Malay Archipelagos? Why is Joseph Hooker in the Himalayas, right? So all of these stories are quite rich, and it retells how imperialism is actually tied into a lot of the things we understand today. Science benefited in a way from colonial expansion and standardization, and also promoted at times colonial expansion, anthropology being one of the disciplines classifying humans and things like that. So it's a massive beast, and there's a lot of work that comes ahead of it, but also just because I work on the British Empire doesn't mean it's the only one. There's the French Empire, Portuguese Empire, Spanish Empire, Ottoman Empire. All of these are such rich stories, and we have to start routing out of Europe and looking at these other influences around the world.
Yeah. And so just expanding on that, perhaps you could tell us a little bit of a history of looking at imperialism and science and colonialism and science. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there have been various historians of science who have established this connection. What's happening more recently is this idea of science and empire has collided with the global move in the history of science. So it's not just looking at what, you know, say, agents of British Empire are doing in place. It's also looking at how this is a global story, what other languages are involved in the process, what other original sources of knowledge are involved, whether it's indigenous or say it's Arabic or Islamic sciences. So how do these actually come together? It's also looking at who's out there in the field, who are they reading, what sources have existed long before. We're sort of moving away what would be like the golden age narrative of Islamic sciences had their peak at one point, and then you go back to the West, and then the West redistributes. What my story tells you is that even in the 19th century, there's so much development and creativity between the North African, Middle East, and South Asia context, because you have this long Islamic route. It's just what I happen to focus on. But there's a lot of exciting research in North America, in Australasia, and the East as well, that's colliding. And again, it's looking at how they talk to each other, because while we're talking about British imperialism in South Asia, you know, China is right next door, and so is Russia. So what's the story and the connections there? I think that's the sort of direction where this new science and colonialism development, the local understanding of the discipline.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm interested, you talked a little bit about the global history of science. For those that haven't come across this as a term, could you tell us a little bit about this rise of global history of science?
In, I believe it's 2008, there's an ISIS focus section on the global history of science. And it kind of shows, again, where the discipline is and what it is. There's a few wonderful pieces, including Marwell Shockery's Knowledge in Motion, and Sudhir Subandaram also has a piece in there as well. It kind of, again, shows what's at stake by going global. So there is something that is called science, and it has influenced how the world has been shaped today. And what's important for us is to study how that happens. Whether it's, you know, the 20th century, the 19th century, or even ancient history of science, an area that's receiving a lot more attention these days and needs to expand further in context. The global trend is just acknowledging that there are other parts of the world apart from the West, but also they talk to each other and are related to each other. There's a lot of different languages. There's a lot of different religious traditions. There's sets of knowledge that we even haven't encountered, and also different sources. So not just primary sources and archives, there's oral histories as well, and stories that have fact embedded in them and artifacts that have been lost to time. So I think the global trend has been really exciting. And only I think in the last 10 years has it reached a fever pitch. in a way that we're getting all these really exciting new stories and regions and relationships of the world through the discipline, but also, again, focusing on the local and not losing those micro histories that are so important to showing how influential various disciplines of science and technology are in nation building.
You said that you believe it's important to keep the history of science separate from the history of knowledge. Could you tell me a little bit more about what your point is there?
The big debate is it a subsection of the history of knowledge? Is it, you know, part of just this normal thing? But my view is personally that there is something called science today, and it does shape the world, and we need a distinct field, even though we may not have an overarching methodology. That kind of shows what we do. I think the history of science is a wonderful field because you can be sitting in a talk about somebody discussing the translations of Arabic astronomical texts from the 12th century, and the next person is talking about nuclear movements that happen in, you know, various parts of the world. So it's a discipline that really challenges area studies. Rather than having somebody who studied specific regional context in its history, you can hop around the globe in a really cool way in our discipline. If you're interested in learning about different parts of the world, you can just follow a specific, say, the history of biology, right? You can just go in various parts of the world and just see what people are talking about when it comes to, say, evolution. What's the movement of flora and fauna there? I think the history of science is a wonderful discipline in that regard, but it's only recently that it allows us to look at the world in such a great way. It really allows us to see certain parts of the world in a way, just the way humanities departments have been structured, have never allowed us to do so before. If we all agree that that's the thing we're looking at and what we're doing. I'm a big advocate for the discipline, and I see myself primarily as a historian of science, because that's the thing we are studying and showing its influence.
What an excellent response. I've kind of been struggling with that myself. I do like the history of knowledge, some of the stuff that's coming through there, but I agree that if we focus on science, you can do all of these amazing connective kind of things with it. Anyway, I just was very fascinated personally. I'm interested, what do you find your students, what are they most surprised about? Are there other things that come up that they're surprised about in learning about these connections?
Yeah, definitely. I had two students in Germany who were from Iran, and they were really surprised at how important Persian was in the South Asian context, for example. There are a lot of these connections between certain areas of the world that people sometimes don't recognize until you start studying the history. Again, how interconnected the world really is at certain time periods. So I always, before talking about a certain subject, give a broad lecture on the historical context of the place. One of my favorite lectures, I talk about the US, Canada, and India. It's called Partition, Independence, and Revolution. So how the American Revolution loses ties with the UK, and then Canada again goes and asks for it, and then India has the independence. It just goes to show how imperialism relates back to these three countries that are also part of my life in very different ways, but also how they have various different scientific disciplines that are important. One of my favorite things that I recently taught to my German students was about Operation Paperclip, which was recently popularized by Oppenheimer, where you have a lot of the Nazi scientists who's completely removed of their historical context and taken to the US. Wernher von Braun is the classic example of that. And so they had no idea about this sanitation of historical facts and how it again pushes us to the space race in a way. So again, science and politics is involved. And I really like telling them through stories like that. I love using Google Maps and Google Arts and Cultures features to take students there and then talk about the context and the stories. I teach Islamic sciences. I teach a science and empire class. It's a lot of fun just both going through it, but also seeing what students are interacting with and what they're taking away from the topic. So again, I could talk about this forever. Pedagogy is really close to my heart, but I think I'll leave it at that. It's just the power of narratives.
Excellent. So how do you think studying the history of colonialism and science relates to science and knowledge making today?
That's a great question. And I think the first thing is we have to understand that it's separated, right? Like how we see certain things in the world today are not so what they were in the past. I think one of the best examples would be around when people were celebrating the 150th year of origin and how Darwin became sort of this epicenter of evolutionary biology and the history of it. what ends up happening is then a lot of historians of biology have to fight back against that narrative. In his time period, it wasn't as revolutionary. It's much later on with the emergence of Mendelian genetics and the merge of Darwinian natural selection where it becomes important. So like Peter Bowler's work, Jim Secord's work, Bernie Lightman's work, all of these, there's so many works on the history of biology that is different. How we understand it today is not how it was understood in the 19th century. There are so many different thoughts at play. Ernst Haeckel's ideas as well, you know, Said Ahmed Khan and like Muslim views of evolution. So before we have the modern paradigm of evolutionary biology, there's a long story of so many different things. It's not just evolution v. creationism. It's all these different ideas. Again, there's no understanding of genetics as we have now. And what we understand today may not hold in the future. I think that's the exciting part on what's important and why we study these certain things. And the same thing about colonialism. There's different disciplines. There's disciplines of post-colonialism as well. It's intersecting with these ideas and making people understand that just because we know something in a certain way now, it wasn't like that before. I know it's very simple, but for some people, it's a very novel idea to be like, oh, there was something that existed before the periodic table? What is phlogiston chemistry? So it's just understanding that these ideas, again, because we've been in history of science for so long, we take for granted that we didn't know that at one point. And making sure every time we're talking, it's not just to each other in a silo, but go from point one. I'm doing a talk in December to Italian chemists where we're actually talking about the history of chemistry. And that's exactly the story when I asked them what came before the periodic table. And it's quite fun doing these talks with scientists and the public and engaging with them. Because for a lot of them, again, they study these things in depth, but have never taken like 5-10 minutes to step back and say, why is this the way it is? So that's why studying, for example, science and colonialism, you can also see, again, why certain ways of the world are the way they are and how we understand different relationships that people have with each other. So again, growing up in Canada in near Toronto, quite multicultural. So we had people from all kinds of backgrounds. And as I leave and explore more of the world, I realize how much I took that for granted to have such a multicultural context where we have people from all walks of life talking to each other and then being able to understand in this setting. So it's one of the reasons I love studying various languages is just to be able to connect and relate to people to a certain extent has been a wonderful part of being a scholar. And I think that's the heart of the humanities in a way.
Before I ask the final question, I just wanted to go back to, you mentioned Marwa al-Shakri's Reading Darwin in Arabic. I've got that on my shelf. I was just interested, what was it that inspired you particularly about that book?
Oh my gosh, it was page 120, 121, where al-Shakri literally writes that Jamaluddin al-Afghani was in Calcutta and he published a book against Sayyid Ahmed Khan. So this is one of the reasons where having diverse voices makes you understand. So again, I grew up hearing the name Sayyid Ahmed Khan. Anybody who isn't in that context wouldn't have found it as significant as I did. So I stopped there and I was like, why is this man here in this text, in this book about the Middle East? And it was that moment where I was like, there is a broader story, a relationship between al-Afghani and Sir Sayyid Ahmed Khan, between the Middle East and South Asia that does not involve Europe. That was the sort of light bulb that led me down this path. I'm very grateful for that. And every time I give a talk, I always have to give Marwa credit because that was my light bulb moment. And it wasn't so much a gap, but a black hole. Since 2014, in the last 10 years, there's been so much more work in the area. But again, putting together South Asia studies, Islamic studies, and the history of science back then was quite a big thing. And now I want to see more intersections of these disciplines, not just say South Asia and history of science, but material culture, history of science, area studies, they all come together. And I think interdisciplinary work is the way to move forward.
Mm. I don't know if you found this, this is just a personal side, but in the work that I do is the layers of knowledge you need. You don't just need knowledge about whatever the science is or those particular people, you need big historical knowledge, cultural knowledge. And so having interdisciplinary teams makes much more sense. I've spoken with David Kaiser and he's said, what we need to do is have more people together working in these areas because they do require such variety of knowledge and you get such a rich outcome. I would imagine you would agree with that.
100%. And it comes back to asking universities to restructure their systems as well and reward interdisciplinary collaborative work at the end of the day. Because imagine if I could spend 10 years learning Persian, or I could work with somebody who already reads Farsi fluently, and we could write a more significant paper together. So I am co-authoring several pieces with colleagues and friends who speak other languages and work on different regional contexts. And the hope is that this becomes a sort of model. Again, the system does not reward these sorts of things, but for personal commitment, it's been a big part of my own experience. I started out publishing in edited collections. I was told not to because there's not enough quote unquote credit, but that's how my career started. And I was introduced to massive groups of people. So my first two publications, one was in Bernie Lightman's Reexamining Complexity and this Cambridge Companion to Sayyid Ahmed Khan. And through that, I was exposed to senior scholars who work on Sayyid Ahmed Khan and senior scholars who work on science and religion, and was able to build networks through that. So it may not have been rewarding, quote unquote, the way the system does, but for me personally, it was enriching and it helped me build a community. I try and do the same now that I'm sort of early career-ish post-PhD, is to the younger students to tell them that people will give you all sorts of advice, but find the thing that works for you. I love having a community and I love collaborating people globally. That was the sort of motivation behind Virtual HISTEM, which was the community we built during COVID. It was, I want to keep talking to people. It may not be the way things work, but it's the way I want things to work. And it's what's leading me down slowly the path. And again, you know how terrible the job market is, but you hope that at the end of the day, you have a career that you can look back at and say, that was pretty cool.
Yes. I'm interested to know, where would you like to see research on science and colonialism and imperialism, as well as global history of science? Let's go big picture. Where would you like to see that head in the future?
I think the main thing I want to see is more multilingual collaborations. They're already taking place in a really cool way. And a lot of us are advocating for publications to be translated, having the original language, also having English language translations available. So I would like to see a lot more collaborative research, people who are working on different parts of the discipline coming together and trying to put their heads together in their areas of knowledge, focusing on local indigenous knowledge, platforming scholars from the regions as well, and giving them resources to continue doing work that we could, you know, again, 1 year of someone in the local language versus 10 years of study, it's just a no-brainer. Putting together a new canon for the discipline that reflects the global, the imperial, but also the core of the discipline, which is these stories. You know, Copernicus did exist. We have to talk about these shifts and changes, but also he wasn't the only one. Also showing how the discipline interacts with other disciplines. I think what we need now is this new sort of textbook that shows where is translations in the discipline, what is global, what is science and colonialism, what is still, you know, science, and how is it different from the history of knowledge? And all of that, I think, needs to come together and have a statement of the discipline. I think it's just bringing the world together in quite an optimistic way, but also just giving more money to the humanities.
Yay to that. That is absolutely fantastic. Thank you, Sarah, so much for being our guest on the podcast today. It's been such a great conversation. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you for having me. I actually do feel quite optimistic after that, which is a great place to be.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying season 2 of the HBS podcast, where we discuss all things history, philosophy, and social studies of science for a general audience. To learn more about the podcast, you can check out our website at hbsunimelb.org. There you can also find links to our blog, Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, and Insta accounts, as well as show notes and transcripts for all our episodes. I'm Samara Greenwood, and my co-producer is Indigo Keel. Together, we would like to thank the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne for their ongoing support of the podcast. We look forward to having you back again next time.